Welcome once again to our program, Salvation History, the New Testament, the story of the redemption or the deliverance or the liberation of humankind by God's action in the world, in history, preparing to send His Son to deliver us from sin and Satan. I'm Monsignor Larry Moran, chaplain of the Carmelite Monastery and John Paul II Catholic High here in Terre Haute. Our series of programs is presented by our guest, Ron Eldred, who also teaches religion and history at John Paul II Catholic High School at 12 Points. And we've been giving a little preparation for the New Testament story of deliverance and redemption, particularly with a little background of the Old Testament types in the Old Testament that are concealed, in the New Testament concealed in the Old, and the Old Testament revealed in the New. We talked about the great influence of the Greek empires under Alexander the Great and the Roman Empire, the great Pax Romana, the Roman peace that had spread across the world at the time of Jesus. And now we're focusing specifically on the Holy Land in which Jesus spent his whole life, and some of the main figures that Jesus, of course, dealt with in the history of the Holy Land. So Ron, welcome once again, and I think King Herod the Great was one person who was cooperating unknowingly with God's plan for the healing and the salvation of the world in a negative way, because he certainly was an evil king. Could you tell us something about King Herod the Great, who was certainly known for his magnificent buildings and architectural achievements?
We discussed King Herod at some length in our series on the Old Testament, so I won't say too much about him right now. He'll come up later, of course, in the series when we get into the Incarnation especially. He was called the Great as much as any reason for his numerous grandiose building projects. For the most part, he better deserves the name Herod the Terrible. He was the king of the Jews for 37 years, from 40 to 4 B.C. Those dates are pretty important, especially the 4 B.C., as you will see later on. Herod was an Idumean, and only technically a Jew. But he wasn't accepted as one of the stricter Jews, most of the stricter Jews, in part because he led such a decadent lifestyle. It was partly because he wasn't a Jew, you know, racially, so to speak, although very closely related. Again, he led such a decadent lifestyle. Certainly the Pharisees looked down their nose at him. He was as famous for his building projects as he was infamous for his evil ways. He built Caesarea, I think is the way in Latin you would properly pronounce it, on the Mediterranean coast, also Caesarea Palestine or Caesarea Maritime, or Maritima, because it was, you know, next to the Mediterranean Sea. Mm-hmm. To distinguish it, it was given that name to distinguish it from Caesarea Philippi, which is named, of course, after one of Herod's sons, Philip. It was the Roman civil capital of Palestine, Caesarea was. It's where Pontius Pilate lived. The Romans used the city as the headquarters of the Roman governor of Palestine, whoever it happened to be. And, of course, Pontius Pilate was the one during the time when Christ was crucified. Herod had a palace named the Praetorium built as the residence for the procurator or the governor. Population consisted mainly of pagans and a few thousand Jews. Roman soldiers were garrisoned there as well, if I recall right, I think around 3,000. And if I also recall right, they were more auxiliary troops. They weren't so much from Italians, but they were recruited from some of the other countries that the Romans had conquered. It wasn't a whole legion, actually. Herod also enlarged Samaria, the city of Samaria, which he named Sebaste in honor of Augustus, and also built many public buildings, pagan temples, and other structures in various parts of his kingdom, and even some outside of it. He built several fortresses throughout his kingdom, at least three or four that I can think of, but his most famous work was the rebuilding of the temple at Jerusalem.
Okay, how about something about his evil ways?
He's most notorious for his role in the slaughter of the holy innocents in connection with the visit of the Magi to the infant Jesus. We'll talk about that story later, of course, when the time comes, but it is known that he ordered the execution on flimsy grounds, or none at all, of at least five members of his own family, including three sons, and then, of course, not to speak of a great number of other real or fancied enemies. In fact, his cruelty was so great that Augustus is said to have remarked, that is, the emperor, making a Greek pun, so he'd have to actually have the Greek language to the words, the actual words, of course, that Augustus used when he heard about different things, that stories would get to him about Herod. He said that it was better to be Herod's pig than his son, because as a Jew of sorts, he wouldn't eat pork. But that doesn't mean anything, of course, of the pun. It had to be the Greek words. Keep in mind now, the upper classes, for the most part, spoke Greek. That was the sophisticated language. Not that they didn't speak Latin, at least certainly in public, but among themselves, probably the more educated Romans spoke Greek. Herod had five wives, by whom he had at least 10 children. And he died a miserable death in 4 BC, mourned by no one. In fact, he ordered that 1,000 men be killed after his death, so at least people would mourn the loss of loved ones during his funeral and burial. In his will, which was ratified by Augustus, he left his kingdom to his three sons, Archelaus, or Calus, sometimes you'll hear it pronounced, Herod Antipas, and Philip. Those were three surviving sons. As I said, three of his other sons were killed. In fact, he actually killed his favorite wife, Mariamne. He thought she was plotting against him. She probably was. And then those three sons of hers that were killed, along with 300 of their buddies, were also killed, and they were probably plotting against him, too.
Well, as you say, Herod the Terrible might be a more appropriate title than Herod the Great. Mention something about that he rebuilt the temple, which was one of his greatest architectural achievements.
That's right. The temples were the center of religious life for the Jewish people under the Old Covenant, and of course for Jesus during his life on earth. The Catechism states that, quote, Jesus venerated the temple by going up to it for the Jewish feast of pilgrimage, and with a jealous love he loved the dwelling of God among men. The temple prefigures his own mystery. When he announces its destruction, it is as a manifestation of his own execution and of the entry into a new age in the history of salvation, when his body would be the definitive temple.
Okay, what about the first temple period?
Yes, I think it's be useful to kind of summarize what we said about the different temples, because we spent quite a bit of time on this in the series on the Old Testament. And the first temple period, this was actually the one that during Herod's time was actually the third temple. But the first temple period was from the year 1006 to 586 BC. And when David conquered Jerusalem in about 104 BC, he declared it the capital of his kingdom, renaming it the city of David. The city contained Mount Moriah, which was considered a holy place, And it was a location, on, at least it's believed to have been, on which Abraham had bound his son Isaac for sacrifice. David brought the Ark of the Covenant to the city, and Jerusalem became the political and spiritual center of the Jewish people. David left the task of building the temple to his son Solomon, though. That's a story that we told in our series on the Old Testament. Solomon's temple was greatly expanded. It was a greatly expanded version of Moses' little portable tabernacle. But it was made of stone, of course, obviously, instead of cloth or skins or something of that sort. Upon the completion of the temple, famed for its luxurious splendor, the Ark of the Covenant was placed in the Holy of Holies. That was one of the rooms in this temple. Solomon built his palace in an area that separated the summit of the mountain and the temple from the city below. And Jerusalem became a place of pilgrimage and an important commercial center because of the concentration of religious ritual at the temple. This temple was destroyed, as we pointed out in our series, in 586 BC when the Babylonians conquered Jerusalem and carried off the Jewish leadership into captivity into Babylonia. And then there was a second temple period. In 538 BC, a proclamation by King Cyrus of Persia, who had conquered Babylon, permitted the exiles to return to Jerusalem. The people were led by the prophets Esdras and Nehemiah. Ezra, a priest of the family of Aaron, was born to the Babylonian exile. And when the enemies of Israel sent letters to the Persian king demanding that the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem should cease, those were mostly Sumerians who sent that letter, the Persian king, Artaxerxes I, sent him to Jerusalem with royal authority to carry out the work of reconstruction, that is, he sent Ezra. He journeyed to Jerusalem with a large body of Jews, taking with him the sacred vessels of the temple, which the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar had carried off about 50 years before that, when they conquered Jerusalem and destroyed the walls of the city and a good part of the city, plus the temple. His first order to the Israelites was to prescribe fasting and prayer to obtain the blessing of God. And he got rid of the priests and Levites who had married heathen women and were unwilling to divorce them. And then Ezra governed the Jews until the arrival of Nehemiah. Now Nehemiah, he was born into a priestly family at Babylon also. And in the 20th year of Artaxerxes I, in 445 BC, he returned to Jerusalem. And he led the work of the rebuilding of the walls. We find this in Nehemiah 1-6. And with Ezra, helped restore the worship of God. And it was during the following so-called Persian period, that is when the Persian Empire actually controlled the Holy Land at that time, that a much smaller and less sumptuous temple was built. This is the so-called Second Temple. And as the leader and governor of Jerusalem, Nehemiah required every family in Judah to send 10 of its members to live in Jerusalem, thus increasing the city's small population. And during this period, the walls were rebuilt and the city fortified. And this second temple period was to last until the reign of King Herod. Sometimes it's called Ezekiel's temple, in addition to the second temple. Now, Ezekiel didn't actually live during this period of time. Ezekiel had been a Jewish prophet, back during the time of the conquering of the city in 586, and he was one of those carried off into captivity. So he was one of the leaders and one of the prophets for the Jews in Babylon during the period of captivity. And he was always encouraging them to rebuild the temple someday when they were allowed to go back. In fact, he even had drawings, and if I recall right, all kinds of instructions, which are described in the Bible as to how this temple should be built. So that's why it's called sometimes called Ezekiel's temple, although he was not involved in the actual building of it.
Okay.
And then, of course, finally, we get to King Herod's temple, the one, of course, that existed during Jesus' time. And this was his most famous and grandest work. And This was the temple that Jesus knew and loved because it was his Father's house. The rebuilding of the temple began in 20 BC and continued until 63 AD, so a period of, over 80 years. And I don't think it was even finished when it was destroyed by the Romans in the year 70 AD, if I recall right. Long after Herod grew ill and died at Jericho in 4 BC, the temple was still being built. Herod employed 10,000 workmen, 1,000 of whom were priests, trained as carpenters and stonemasons, since the law prohibited laymen from entering the temple itself. So the temple had to be built by priests. And so these priests had to learn to be stonemasons and carpenters and other kinds of craftsmen to be able to build the temple. And there was another interesting thing about that is that they didn't want noise, around close to the temple. And so the stone had to be come from, some distance away, or there was an underground quarry where they were able to get a lot of stone, or the fine limestone to build the temple with. And they brought in granite and marble, and other stone, for various parts of it. The outside structure, the superstructure of the temple was stone. The inside, though, was wood, fine wood paneling. Probably the finest paneling that was ever put inside of a building in the history of the world, probably. The temple was built from the same type of soft white stones that were used for Solomon's temple. And as I said, they were shaped several hundred feet away so that you wouldn't have the noise, around the holy place. Keep in mind now, the temple itself actually only had two big rooms. It had a foyer, an outside foyer or something like that. Like when you come in a Catholic church, you come into the foyer and you go through the big doors. Then you go into the main room of the temple, it was called the holy room, and the holy room was sort of like a big sacristy. And then of course they went through a curtain, a double curtain, and they went back into what was called the Holy of Holies. And the Holy of Holies is where the ark was kept. And of course no one was allowed into there, no one, except the high priest, and that was during Yom Kippur, or the Day of Atonement. We talked about those things in our first series. The temple, now this is important. The temple was enclosed within the court of the Gentiles, which covered about 35 acres. Well, when we think of the temple, the grounds covered the whole top of this mountain, Mount Moriah. In fact, the mountain had to be leveled off. And it had not only to be leveled off, it had to be filled in a lot. To make the top of it big enough to accommodate this huge 35-acre courtyard called the Courtyard of the Gentiles. This was a much larger courtyard than the court of the previous temple. And around that huge, all the way around that huge courtyard was Greco-Roman Corinthian columns. They surrounded the interior of the court. And on the south side of the interior of the court, Herod erected a triple colonnade extending 800 feet, called the Royal Portico. It was called this because Solomon had been crowned there. Only Jews were allowed in the temple itself, though. In other words, if you could show it, and I teach this, we have drawings and pictures and all kinds of things. You got this mountaintop all leveled off. You got this huge courtyard called the Courtyard of the Gentiles. And inside this courtyard, the Gentiles, that's the only place they were allowed. And literally, hundreds, thousands of people could get into that place. And then, of course, the places where the merchants sold animals for sacrifice and food and other things like that for sacrifice was around the periphery of this, where these colonnades were at, where these columns were at. And then all the money changers, that's what
the money changers. In the court of the Gentiles?
Yes, in the court of the Gentiles. Okay. As I said, this was a huge court, 35 acres. It was the size of, I think, 20 football fields or something like that. And in the middle of that was the temple proper. Right in the middle of it was the temple proper. And the temple proper had its own big wall around it. And in that wall there was a gate or two, I remember how many gates. And no Gentile was allowed to pass from the court of the Gentiles in through one of those gates into the inner courtyards. For example, there was the court of the women. This was a fairly sizable, you know, little courtyard there. Women were not allowed beyond this court, though. And they had to be Jewish women, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So when, you know, we talk about Mary being into the temple, she would go into the court of the women. Only Joseph would be allowed to go beyond that into the court of the men.
Okay.
So this would have been the court in which Mary and Joseph found Jesus when he was lost, because Mary would not have been allowed to go further into the temple. And the court of the women led into the court of Israel, or sometimes called the court of the men. And any male Jew could enter this area. And inside the court of the men was the court of the priest. I mean, even with inside that, which housed the sacrificial altar and also the big laver, the huge, big bronze container that hold, you know, thousands of gallons of water that they used for their purification rites during the time of their sacrifices. And that, of course, as I said, that's called the court of the priest. An interesting thing, though, going back to the court of the Gentiles, there's that fence that you have, that large stone fence, was a part of the temple proper. No Gentile was allowed to pass into the court of the women, and on certainly not into the court of the women, the men, and then into the court of the priest. In fact, the death penalty was exacted for, including even Romans, even a Roman soldier. And the Romans backed it up.
Really?
Yes. If any Roman soldier would inadvertently would go into there, he actually could be executed by the temple guards.
Wow.
And the Romans, of course, would back that up, would support that that act. The sanctuary, in the back of the court, the priest had two chambers or rooms. In other words, there's actually, now you're getting into the actual temple itself.
Mm-hmm.
Inside all these courtyards, you got a courtyard within a courtyard within a courtyard within a courtyard, and so you're finally getting to the actual temple building itself, which really wasn't real large. I would say it would probably be about the size of Peter and Paul Cathedral over in Indianapolis, which actually is kind of built on, it kind of looks like the temple.
Really?
So I suspect it might be, or maybe not much bigger than Temple Israel on South 6th Street here in Terre Haute.
Okay.
Which is the local Jewish synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect it's probably a little bigger than that, but something probably along that order. And it only had really two rooms in it. Outside of the foyer, when you first went into the foyer, up the steps, a bunch of steps, you went into these big doors, went into the foyer, and then there was the outer room, the sanctuary, the holy room it was called. And then, of course, there was the inner room that had a big double curtain that separated the two rooms, and only the high priest was allowed to go into there. And that's where the Ark of the Covenant was kept, where it was believed that on top of this Ark of the Covenant was the wisdom seat, of course, in which God himself ruled his people. Now, of course, the Ark disappeared after 586. And so by the time of the Romans and to the time of King Herod, the Ark had long been gone. So that room actually was, quote, empty. And in fact, one of the Roman generals, I think it was in 63 B.C., one of the Roman generals in 63 B.C., when the Romans came in and took over, first time they took over the Holy Land and took over Jerusalem, I think it was General Titus, I believe, he actually went into the temple and went through the curtain and went into the Holy of Holies, and there was nothing in there. And he was shocked. He scratched his head, you know, like, what's all of this about? Why do these people get so excited? What he probably expected to see, you know, was some idol,
sure,
like you would see in a Roman or a Greek temple.
Sure.
Like the Temple of Artemis, for example. Well, the sanctuary, it represented Moses' original tabernacle. Once we get away from the actual temple itself, to the north of the temple, that is, we're talking about the whole Mount Moriah now, on which the temple was built. To the north of the temple, a deep valley between the temple area and the Fortress Antonia castle, that is the northwest corner, where that was filled in completely to make the extension of the Temple Mount possible. Herod had named the fortress Antonia to cultivate his friend Mark Antony. We talked about that during our series on the Old Testament. The structure was used for luxurious living quarters, for visiting Roman dignitaries, and to house Roman soldiers. Then there was a second tower was added to the northeast corner called the Golden Gate. And then there was the pinnacle, which was the summit of the enclosed wall at the southeastern corner. It was at a height of 450 feet above the level of the Kidron Valley. This was the height to which Satan took Jesus for his last temptation. And the vaults known as Solomon's Stables were located below the pinnacle, that is, the highest place in the temple on the southeastern corner. The southern side of the structure was supported by a massive structure built into the hill. And the largest of its stone blocks is more than 16 feet long and can be seen from the opposite side of the valley. And the temple was reached by ramps leading upward from the triple double gates. The Temple of Jerusalem was one of the finest structures in the world at the time. I don't think even in Rome or Alexandria or probably any place else in the world you would have found as an impressive a structure as was the Jewish temple in Jerusalem. Herod's temple.
This is the one that Herod built after King Solomon.
Yes, Herod was a great builder. He built some absolutely beautiful, huge palaces and fortresses and rebuilt whole cities and built new cities. He's known, as I said, the positive side of King Herod was he was known for being the great builder. But as we said also, he was also not only Herod the Great. That's why it's called Herod the Great.
Sure.
He was called Herod the Terrible because of the evil things that he did. And he was a very evil man, very suspicious, very evil man.
Now, is he the King Herod to whom Jesus was sent by Pontius Pilate?
No, that would have been Herod Antipas.
His son.
That would have been one of his sons that took over after his death in 4 B.C.
Okay.
After Herod's death, Roman oppression increased, and as a result, Jewish resistance intensified. And eventually a revolt broke out, led by a group of revolutionaries called the Zealots. This is after even Jesus' time. But there were even some before Jesus' time, some outbreaks. The revolutionaries entered Jerusalem in 66 A.D. and held the city until 70 A.D. Now this is during the time, of course, of St. Paul. This is the time of the apostles when all this is going to happen. And we'll talk about that when the time comes. During that year, Jerusalem fell to the Roman legions under the command of Titus. The general I mentioned a while ago earlier in 63 B.C. would have been Pompey,
okay,
instead of Titus. The Romans engaged in a sustained and unrelenting siege that destroyed what had once been one of the most flourishing and beautiful cities in the world, that is Jerusalem. Jerusalem buildings were set on fire, the stones of the city walls and the temple were pulled down, and the people were exiled. Many were sold into slavery. And this ended not only the existence of the temple in 70 AD, again, this is after several years after Christ, of course, has ascended into heaven, but also the Jewish priesthood and animal sacrifices as well.
And ever since that time, the Jewish people had no official sacrifice?
No. There's only one wall that's left from that temple. It's called the Western Wall. Sometimes they call it the Wailing Wall. And Jews go there to pray. And even Pope John Paul II went there to pray when he was in Jerusalem on one occasion.
Okay, Ron, many thanks. Our time again has run out. To our listening audience, we say may God bless you all, always, and in all ways.
Amen.